Hello! Welcome to the Trans-Pacific Tractor Beams edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. Emily, why am I calling it Trans-Pacific Tractor Beams?
I mean, I don't really know, but I think it's because we're discussing trade and tractors for farmers and how the TPP could have been good.
I am Felix Salmon of Axios, and I take full responsibility for the title of this show, and I apologize for it. Emily Peck of HuffPost.
Hello.
You are utterly befuddled by the title of this show, and you are probably like 99% of the listeners. Anna Szymanski, you're the casting vote. Does the title of this show make any sense?
I'm going to go with no.
But
thank you all for listening to this incomprehensibly titled show. I promise you that the actual show itself will make more sense. We will talk about the tractors and the soybeans and the Chinese trade deal. We will talk about Visa buying Plaid for $5.3 billion. And we will talk about the Rooney Rule, which is a way of trying to increase minorities in the upper echelons of an organization and whether it actually works or not. Also, a Slate Plus about Nike Vaporflies, all that and more. We have a great numbers round coming up on Slate Money. Okay, so the big news of the week was a trade deal with China. I mean, there were actually two trade deals this
week.
That's
true.
In case you hadn't noticed, and most people didn't, the UNCTAD got signed, or it wasn't signed, but it was passed by the Senate by a massive bipartisan consensus. You see, bipartisanship is possible. We can all get behind USMCA.
Or USMCA.
Or NAFTA, as it's probably easier to call
exactly.
It. USMCA is the new NAFTA. USMCA is the new NAFTA, I should say. And
maybe you're onto something. We should call it NAFCA.
We could call it NAFCA. Now, I have heard that the main reason that Donald Trump is so keen on USMCA rather than NAFTA is just because it starts with the letters US, and that's America First, quite literally.
Mm. That's true. Also, because he wants to suggest that he has like gotten rid of NAFTA. So if you have a new bill that starts with NAFTA, that is going to indicate that you, in fact, have not gotten rid of NAFTA.
But as we all know, USMCA is not much of a difference from NAFTA. But this phase one trade deal with China,
the best phase.
I mean, like, yeah, exactly. You can't have any other phase if you don't have phase one. So it's got to be a big deal. And it has hundreds of billions of things in it. So thankfully, I have someone here who knows about all of these billions and can unpack it for us, because it gets a bit confusing a bit quickly. So Anna Szymanski.
Yes.
Explain, this doesn't seem to me like a normal trade deal. This seems to me like some kind of a weird promise by China to spend a bunch of money on American goods?
That's because that's pretty much what it is. It is, in fact, not a normal trade deal because it's not really about freeing up trade. It is, in fact, about managing trade. And the centerpiece of this deal are these promised $200 billion in additional purchases.
And this is the Chinese government who's going to make these purchases, or Chinese state-controlled company, or the Chinese government is just going to like twist the arms of private companies?
Exactly. A little bit of all of the above. Right. And the reality, and granted, there are other parts of this, too. There are some nods towards intellectual property protection, although the protections don't look like they're going to be that good. You know, there are a few other things. However, the purchases are really the biggest part of this. And when you start to look at these numbers, this is where pretty much everybody becomes very skeptical about this deal.
So the Chinese have promised to buy a gazillion dollars of like soybeans, and people like you sort of get out your pencil and envelope and you're like, there's no way they're going to be able to buy a gazillion dollars of soybeans. And so what's the remedy in the deal if they don't buy a gazillion dollars?
Well, I mean, this is a really interesting question. I mean, to me, so in December, they started to kind of put out some of these numbers, and that's when everyone was starting to do the math, the soybean math, and was like, no, that's not happening. Now, if you looked at the actual deal, it definitely includes some language that gives you a little bit of wiggle room. So my assumption are two things. One, there is some language that suggests that the Chinese could say that the reason they aren't making these purchases is because of other things that the U.S. are doing, so then they're not in violation. And there's also wiggle room that offers the ability for a little bit of creative accounting to pretend, you know, so you can potentially say like, oh, well, you know, we're going to be buying them in this period, but we're not actually going to be sending them until this other quarter, or we're going to be, you know, not actually paying for them for another year, but then we're going to be booking them in this period. So my guess is if they get to anywhere close to hitting these targets, it's going to be because of creative accounting, not because they're actually buying all these soybeans.
But in terms of if I'm an American soybean producer, I'm no longer really saying, hey, I produce great soybeans and I've put a lot of effort into developing a relationship with soybean buyers in China who want to feed their cows or whatever it is they want to do with my soybeans. Instead, I'm basically saying that I'm going to produce these soybeans and then the American government and the Chinese government are going to come to some kind of a deal. And if the deal works out the way that I hope it'll work out, then the Chinese government will buy my soybeans. And if it doesn't, then they won't. And it kind of feels like infantilizing, and I can't really build up a relationship with a buyer or anything like that, which it takes me out of control of my own business.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. And granted, it wouldn't just be the Chinese government doing all the purchasing. But yes, this is true that, you know, you had a functioning market and then you had Donald Trump come in and essentially destroy this functioning market. And then obviously China started to build up and Chinese buyers started to build up relationships with other providers. You know, Brazil in particular is one that was providing a tremendous amount of soybeans. And so now you have, you know, Donald Trump out there saying, you know, buy tractors to all of these farmers. But these farmers are not stupid. And they are very, very skeptical about this. You know, the statement that came out from the kind of farmers union is basically saying, we are, you know.
Wait, so he's not telling Chinese farmers to buy American tractors. He's telling American farmers to buy American tractors because they're going to
need more
tractors to harvest more soybeans.
Right. It feels like Donald Trump, like it's the equivalent of like I go to the doctor and I have appendicitis and the doctor performs surgery and like cuts a bunch of other stuff and injures me. And then I am hurt, so I go back to the doctor and he fixes all the mistakes he made and sews me up and he's like, I did it, but my appendix is still swollen. Like, nothing has happened. This deal is dumb. Like, he screwed up trade relations between China and the U.S., and now the fix doesn't even get us back to where we were, if I'm understanding this correctly.
Yeah, I mean, look, I know the argument. I think you're 100% correct. I know the argument against that would be like, well, but if you do have, you know, all of these additional exports to China, then that would be moving the needle in terms of the bilateral trade deficit and in terms of exports. It would be different from what you had before. And you almost certainly will have additional exports. But the bigger question is, okay, let's say we even have some magical world where they're able to come up with these magical soybeans and send them, okay? Like, let's pretend that world exists. Even then, what this deal does is it's one more step in breaking the rules-based trade order that supported the growth of global trade and the growth of globalization. And so to me, this deal is another kind of failure of that. And the problem is that if we have more of this type of activity, more of this type of bilateral activity, that is going to be net negative for global trade. It creates more instability and it just creates more animosity because, you know, if you're a trading partner that all of a sudden is going to get a trading partner of China that could be damaged by this. Granted, China saying that's not going to happen, but it almost certainly would have to happen. Well, then you might try to retaliate in other ways.
Right. And I was reading, I think, in the Wall Street Journal that one thing that's interesting about the phase one deal is the arbitration provisions, where so you don't go to some neutral like WTO body to settle. China and the U.S. wouldn't to settle their disputes. There's like rounds of negotiations that take place. And that's sort of like a finger in the eye, another finger in the eye. Fists are in the eye of the WTO.
We covered this on Slate Money. Like, right. They can't go to the WTO because the US government has basically rendered the WTO completely useless. And I think Anna's absolutely right that what this really is a repudiation of capitalism. Like, you used to have this capitalist system where you would set the rules and then let everyone go out and compete and get gains from trade and Ricardian advantage and all of this kind of stuff. And now Trump is like, no, I don't want that. I don't want to play by the rules. I just want to fix the outcome in advance. And that just feels like a deeply not very good idea.
No, I agreed. And it makes me very sad. I don't want to suggest that the previous, you know, WTO-led rules-based order was perfect. It obviously wasn't. The fact that, you know, China and other actors were able to break a lot of the rules suggests that there were clear problems here. But clearly, this activity is showing that this bilateral mercantilist strategy doesn't work either. Like, there needs to be another way. There needs to be some other type of movement forward. And it's interesting because you did then also have Trump making these suggestions that, oh, now I'm going to be working with other countries in order to push back against, you know, Chinese subsidies to their state-owned companies. And you're like, well, yeah, you should have been doing that from the very beginning. And like what like this. And you can't on one hand say, I'm breaking up this multilateral rules-based order. And then the other hand say, I want to use this multilateral rules-based order to get what I want.
So the way that the Americans were trying to create a countervailing force against China before Trump came along was TPP, right? And that was like, we are all going to join up with a bunch of other Pacific Rim countries and create a big force which can, you know, go up against China without having to enter into a trade war. Would that count as would that count in terms of your desire for finding something which would have been better than the status quo ante, but like isn't the Trump solution? Or was that just an incremental thing that wasn't really going to work?
I mean, I do think it was a good step in the right direction. I mean, I was very much in favor of TPP when a lot of people were bashing it for various reasons, because I do think that it was the entire world acknowledging that the system that they'd had previously, where they were kind of saying, oh, you know, like, we're only going to push back on China so far, and obviously individual countries weren't going to push back on China. You know, it really was, I think, a genuine step forward. But obviously, now that has been mostly trashed.
And so, I mean, it exists.
It does.
Right?
It does. But if you don't have the US in it, I mean, like, you can't, like, that's, that doesn't really work, right?
Do you think that if, I don't know, Joe Biden is the next president, that he could join TPP, or would that not happen?
I think it's incredibly unlikely.
I feel like people, Americans, don't care about trade or trade deals that much, except for no one like
NAFTA. There's one person in America who really, really, really cares about trade and trade deals.
Bernie Sanders.
Donald Trump.
Right. Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, who's like on... Actually, they're kind of aligned. If you watch...
No, they are. They're actually very...
The Democratic debate this week, they spent a lot of time talking about trade, and it just struck me as such a waste of time because I don't think Democratic voters, beyond not liking NAFTA... No one cares. Like,
which is a problem.
Most people, what USMCA is, I think they'd be like, ah, which is actually
kind of
good.
I think it's a new kind of sports league.
It's actually kind of good branding if you think about it, because we spent the past, like, what, two decades really polarized over NAFTA, NAFTA, NAFTA. Mm-hmm. So now you sort of like gotten rid of that, and there's the polarization could kind of go away at this point because
right.
No one
knows it's hard to find Americans who hate WTO or TPP or USMCA in the way they hated NAFTA. You're absolutely right. And but by the same token, you're not going to find a huge amount of non-completely wonkish Americans who are particularly in favor of them either. It's just like, yeah, what? Who? I'm much more interested in USWNT.
Yeah. Women's
National Team.
I just think at a policy level, like, there's just not much impetus behind any of this. And maybe a Biden would do differently because his powerful donors and, you know, they would have some sway over him, and most Americans don't care. So you can kind of go in and
also because it's legitimately actually important. Like, you know, you've had there are legitimate criticisms that the U.S. manufacturing sector and other sectors have against what China has done. And the way that you counter that is going to be through trade activity globally. Organized trade activity. So it's actually incredibly important. I agree with you that I don't think actually anybody cares. However,
we care.
If people want to get to where they want wages to increase it, like, this kind of thing is actually really important.
And the United Nations just came out with a big global report showing that global trade grew in 2019 at 0.3%, which is by far the lowest growth rate in a decade. So yeah, we got some work to do here.
And that's bad for stability, right? Political stability, mm-hmm. Like world
and,
peace.
And it's
kind
bad
of
for stability. It's bad for economic growth. Yeah. It's bad for
it's a, yeah.
Oh, Trump.
It's bad.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Okay, so we have apps now. What I didn't realize is that they've really grown in the past 4 years. I've had a few. I guess I was an early adopter. I've had a few little baby fintech appy things on my phone for a long time. I got a Simple Card when they launched. And so I was like, yeah, there are these online banks. They've been doing things for a while. There's Venmo. There's Square Cash is super popular these days. And I was like, yeah, this is a thing. Okay, whatever. It's just a different way of moving money around on the same old rails. Big deal. Turns out it's a big deal because Visa, which is used to be owned by the banks, was then spun off into this massive IPO and is much more than just a credit card company. It's one of the main sort of financial infrastructure companies which moves money around the planet. They just bought this startup called Plaid for $5.3 billion, which is an enormous amount of money. It's like 50 times their revenues.
Yeah. And Square trades at like 10 times its revenues.
Right. And so they're like, this is obviously, in Visa's eyes, a hugely important strategic move. And so the big question is, like, what is Plaid? What does it do that Visa doesn't do? And why does Visa value it so highly? And what does that tell us about the world? Can you answer all of those questions?
I mean, I know what Plaid, you know, the basics is that it's the kind of API. It's basically the connecting apps to the banks, right? It's that kind of infrastructure.
Connects your Venmo to your JP Morgan.
Right. So if you have a Venmo account, if I Venmo you money, what's ultimately happening on some level is that money comes out of my bank account and it goes into your bank account. And Venmo therefore needs some kind of access to both of our bank accounts. And Venmo does not do that itself. Venmo uses Plaid to do that because Plaid is better at that than the only company that used to do this, which was this company called Yodlee, and everyone hated Yodlee. So these, you know, two guys started Plaid because they're like, we can do better than Yodlee. And it was true. They could do better than Yodlee. And so now everyone uses Plaid. And, you know, the banks don't love this because it means that your login credentials are basically out there in the wild being used to transfer money in and out of your bank account, and they don't have control over that. And then you can go up to them and say, a bunch of money left my bank account. And they're like, well, you gave your password to Venmo or all these other companies. But by the same token, the banks realize that people want to be able to use these apps and they can't make it completely impossible. So Plaid has kind of made itself an indispensable, pretty low-down layer in that ecosystem.
So banks would rather deal with Visa than Plaid, probably, because Plaid is just some startup, and Visa, they know Visa.
So that definitely,
so that's, I think, their end of it.
And I think that's, if that's true for American banks, it's even more true for international banks. And Visa is this, you know, globally recognized, copper-bottomed financial services behemoth, and if Visa goes along to international banks and says you're really going to have to allow access to this utility to allow people to access their money in the way they want to access it, that's going to be an easier sell than if it's this American startup called Plaid.
And then from Visa's end, they want Plaid because the fear, I guess, is that credit cards are going away. And soon, no one will need Visa anymore.
Well, I don't think so.
I mean, I yes and no. Like, I don't necessarily think credit cards are going away. But I mean, I do think
people use them less.
Yeah, I mean, I do think part of the reason that Visa paid as much as they did is because they definitely can see that the way people are moving money is changing, and it is changing rapidly, and that is going to continue. And I think they kind of want to get out in front of that. And they're, because, you know, obviously these credit card companies do still extract a lot of rents. Basically, you know, they're getting paid fees every time money's moving around. And I do think that there is some fear that as that system changes, that's not, it, we're not anywhere close to that system really changing. But if it did, then that could cut into their business model. And so they want to get out in front of that. And that's part of the reason they're willing to pay as much as they did.
I don't think credit cards are going away, but I do think that Visa sees an opportunity to extend its model to beyond just credit cards. And they've done that already with debit cards, right? That was the first big move they made, what, like 15, 20 years ago, was the Visa debit card. And that turned out to be very popular, both domestically and internationally. And then this is like the next, you know, the idea is that Visa is becoming what someone described as a network of networks. And so they're bringing on a whole bunch of different networks so that however you want to be intermediating your financial services, they are the company that is going to do that. I don't think, as Anna says, that it's because they see credit cards going away. I think credit cards have a huge amount of utility, especially in the United States and the United Kingdom. But, you know, there are lots of other countries where that isn't how people pay for things and move money around. And so they want to be able to meet people wherever they want to be.
It does seem like we are literally heading towards a world without literal cards. That's going away. People use their phones now so much more and apps more than they used to. Like, I just visually see this in my day-to-day life, that people aren't taking out cards as much as they used to.
So that there is contactless, and contactless, it's really interesting to see how it has taken off enormously in some countries and not in others. Mm-hmm. Australia, it's really big. UK, it's really big. US, it's creeping up slowly. And interestingly, the big winner in the contactless, in the rise of contactless in the United States is Apple. That something like two-thirds, or I think it's over half of all contactless payments in the United States are made via Apple Pay, which surprises me, but apparently it's a thing.
You have your phone all the time. That's right, the thing you have all the time,
but like,
so of course.
But Apple phones are a minority of phones.
You stumped me. I'm sorry.
But yeah, I mean, but I think Apple has just made tapping your phone somehow easier than Android has. It's a little bit like podcasts. You know, Apple was a minority of phones, but everyone used to listen to Apple podcasts. It was always the big dominant way that people used to, and still do, listen to podcasts. And you're like, why isn't like an Android app competing with this? Because most people have Android phones, not Apple phones. And I've never really got a good answer to that question.
So yeah, if you're getting towards a world where more people are using their phones to pay for stuff, like, there's going to be more innovation and more plaids and fewer Visa.
Remember that if you put your, like, if you pay with Apple Pay, let's say that you're paying with an Apple card on Apple Pay, what you're paying is with a MasterCard.
Right.
And you're going over the MasterCard rails. And then you can just as easily put a Visa card in Apple Pay and pay with the Visa card.
Right, no.
You're still using your credit card.
And this is what I think is, because, yeah, so it's not, clearly nothing right now is changing that dramatically. But I do think this is interesting as like an antitrust kind of thing, because you're thinking of they are kind of doing a little bit of like what Facebook did, you know, and kind of buying competitors in utero. And now I'm not saying that Plaid is going to necessarily be a competitor to Visa, but I do think when you have a behemoth, this kind of payments behemoth like Visa, buying this kind of company, partly with the idea of, we think that payments are going to eventually, like, this is going to be a big part of the market, and we want to be a big player in there, so we're going to buy this. I just wonder how that'll look down the line. You know what I mean?
I couldn't agree more. I think you're absolutely right. And when I saw the news, my heart sank. And my first reaction to this was, like, right now, Plaid is growing very fast by being all things to all people. And anyone who wants to use it to connect to anyone else, they're like, yeah, use us to connect to anyone else, anything going on anywhere in the world. Now that they're owned by Visa, certain applications of Plaid, certain potential customers, existing and potential future customers of Plaid, on some level are going to be competing with Visa. And Visa is going to now be faced with a choice, and they're going to have to say, are we going to allow this tiny little Plaid part of our business to cannibalize the main part of our business, that is credit cards? Or are we going to start restricting the number of people who can use the Plaid service in order to shore up our core credit cards networks? And, you know, that might not happen for a couple of years, but it is almost certainly that question is going to start getting raised at some point. And I agree with Anna that, like, there's something monopolistic about this. Visa and MasterCard are, of course, a huge duopoly. And anything that strengthens that massive duopoly is not a good thing.
Yeah. And not good for consumers. I mean,
this podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Emily, who is Rooney?
He is the guy who came up from the NFL.
Dan Rooney. He was the owner of the Steelers, I think.
Yes, the owner of the Steelers.
The Steelers is an American football team.
It is indeed.
Okay.
And he came up with the Rooney Rule in 2003.
So he created a rule, and it was such a good rule that they named it after him.
Yeah. It's okay. Big. The rule is big. So the rule was just that in 2003, the NFL was kind of having a reckoning with the fact that there were just very few black head coaches. In one season, I think two or three were fired, Tony Dungy among them. And there was a lot of upset. Johnny Cochran was involved. He was going to sue for racial discrimination. It was really big news. And then Rooney comes up with the rule, which is, don't worry, we're gonna fix this. We're going to bring in, anytime there's a head coach opening, we'll bring in at least one minority candidate to interview, and that'll be a requirement. The NFL adopts this requirement. And for the next few years, a few more black head coaches do get hired. So the number goes up from like 2 to 6 to 8.
So the chap from the Philadelphia, what do we call
it?
Pittsburgh Steelers.
Pittsburgh Steelers mm-hmm. implements this rule. Mm-hmm. And then the NFL, which is the whole league, says that's a really good rule and mm-hmm. forces all of the other owners to do the same thing.
Yes. So all the teams have to at least interview one candidate less, or they get fined.
And the rule has stayed in effect to the present day and it still exists.
Yes. The rule still exists. So the rules exist the whole time. And it looks like it's working somewhat for the NFL. Meanwhile, a lot of companies, especially tech companies, are coming under fire for not hiring any non-white people or not any women. So a lot of companies start saying, we're going to use the Rooney Rule too. It's such a good rule. So it becomes really popular right alongside in the NFL.
It becomes like a management fad.
Yeah. It's like if you get criticized for something, you can say, oh, we're going to do the Rooney Rule. Like Amazon had an all-white board a few years ago and activist investors said, you should adopt the Rooney Rule. And at first they said, no, we're not going to do it. And then people got very upset with them, including their employees. And they were like, okay, fine, we'll do it. So now they do it, and they put two black women on their board.
What is the reason why people might not want to adopt the Rooney Rule?
I mean, Amazon told, they said at first, there's research that shows the Rooney Rule just doesn't work, and also common sense. So if you're hiring, you have like four candidates in your final round, and one of them is not like the others, there is perhaps unconsciously, you kind of think, well, that's a different, I don't want that different person, no matter woman, non-white or whatever. So there might be some natural prejudice. And there's some research done that shows that if you just have one minority or a female candidate in your pool, they're, statistically, their chance of getting hired is essentially zero. It doesn't work. So you have to have at least two or three candidates in your, and you have to have a diverse slate of candidates.
So wait, the argument against adopting the Rooney Rule is One is basically the same as zero, so we may as well stick with the zero.
Yeah, I mean, there's no, it's disingenuous, I think, to argue against it because it's not even, it there's feels no like, reason not to
it.
Do
feels
it.
Like the bare minimum.
There's no really. Reason
like,
not
if
to
you
do
don't
it.
Have a minority candidate, you're pretty much guaranteed not to hire one.
Exactly. Right. There's no reason not to do it, which is why there was such an uproar over Amazon and they right. quickly were like, no, 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 we'll do it. Fine, sorry. But that said, the rule itself, it's not very effective because of what I just said. If just one, if it's just one candidate, statistically, zero chance. So it's cool to do the Rooney rule, and a lot of companies have, but if you don't do other stuff, then nothing is right. going to change in your company, as evidenced by the NFL. We're talking about it this week.
Well, yeah, why were you talking about it this week?
Because head coach hiring season is kind of just wrapped up, and we're down to only 3 black head coaches in the NFL and 1 Hispanic coach. Everyone else is a white guy. There were 5 open positions this season, and 4 were filled again by white guys, and there's a lot of debate like in the sports.
And it's all male?
Yes.
Yeah. And there's a lot of debate in the sports world over, like, did the most qualified candidates even win? They point to this guy and they say, oh, he only coached 1 season in the NFL, and this qualified black coach, you know, he coaches like the MVP quarterback in the league. And, you know, there's a lot of it's quite controversial. But it just got me thinking about this rule that all these companies are like, we do it. And like,
so well, in business, does it work about as well as it works in the NFL, which is like if you're doing it because, you know, the NFL or some activist shareholder or something is forcing you to do it, then it's not really going to make any difference. You have to actually want to hire minorities in order to be able to effectively hire minorities.
So in business, the rule alone probably isn't going to work beyond maybe the board where it's very easy. You have 10 slots to fill and you can kind of really intentionally get it done.
Well, I mean, I guess even at board level, there's a huge difference between we want to have a minority board member versus when we're hiring a new board member, one of the candidates needs to be a minority.
Yeah. You have to sort of have both be true in order for it to affect change. And then in the business world, the Rooney Rule alone doesn't work. And the companies that use it that have been successful in diversifying a little bit do a lot of other stuff. Like they look at, you know, where their weaknesses are. Like I was looking at Airbnb is very intentional about this stuff. And they looked at their hiring process, which was like 3-stage process. And one of the stages, they noticed there was a lot of drop off of women and minority candidates. And that stage was where the engineers like go in a room and like do something at a board. And I'm an editor. I don't know what they do with the board, but they like do stuff with stuff and people evaluate them in the room. And they found out that's where like a lot of women were dropping out. So they kind of intentionally then like revamped how that process worked. So they had like the woman have like an informal coffee with someone on the staff. So and made sure that person was in the room. So they knew someone in the room. And they always made sure there was another woman evaluating whatever happens on the whiteboard. I don't know. And then that actually like increased the number of women they were hiring. So it's like you have to be like a scientist, like kind of tinkering with all this stuff. You can't just be like, have one minority person.
Well, and I think one of the things you saw in the NFL, which I think has parallels outside of the NFL, is that one of the reasons that you don't have as many African-American or Hispanic head coaches is because you don't have as many offensive coordinators who are African-American or Hispanic. And that tends to be, there tends to be, it's often you pick from offensive coordinators. You also don't have as many head coaches in college football who are a minority. And so I think
this is the pipeline defense, which we've heard in a bunch of different places.
And I'm not defending it. I'm saying that when you're thinking about the Rooney Rule, you would need to have it at every level. It can't just be at the top level, which is essentially what it was. If you want there to be enough candidates, so eventually you wouldn't even need the Rooney Rule because you would just have so many candidates, it wouldn't, you know, you need to start at lower levels. You need to start pushing people at lower levels to get into the types of positions that get you on that track.
But here's the thing also, I was reading some article I missed because I wrote a story about this week, a study from a few years ago that ESPN wrote up. Basically, the problem is baked in at the entry level, just like you were saying, Anna, because of discrimination against black coaches who are hired at like they're promoted at half the rate
right.
of white coaches. Like it's just baked in, and the study looked pretty good. They kind of controlled for everything else, every other possible idea. Like, is it because more white people coach quarterbacks versus this or that or that? And they controlled for everything. And it's just like basic racism like kind of baked in the system. So you really need to go, like you're saying, back down to the entry level and sort of make that all right too. Like you have to work at every layer of the cake.
And I think it, within sports, I think it's just so glaring because so many of the athletes are obviously minorities. I mean, so it's like you, when you're thinking of where ultimately coaching talent is from, usually coaches have played at some levels. Now, sometimes coaches haven't actually played at the professional level, but often they have, or they played at the college level, the high school, whatever. And so it just seems so absurd that when you have this enormous pool of talent, that somehow that's not getting into these leadership roles. I mean, I think, and this is something that it is this kind of racist thing that you see, and I think in football you see it, it's most glaring because football is kind of a weird team sport because you have a leader like quarterbacks. Like historically, quarterbacks have almost always been white. Mm. That is changing, thankfully, but you still see a tremendous amount of white. And I think because there is still these like racist assumptions about who is best fit for a leadership role.
Absolutely. And I think the parallel to corporate America is pretty right. obvious. You see the same things at the entry level. It's like half women. And at the top, it's like 80% men. So what's happening? And there's always a lot of blame about mothers and stuff. But we all know that's not the story, right?
I mean, right. There's more going on. Obviously, yes. It's incredibly hard for women who have kids to do what in theory you are expected to do into these roles. But then the idea is, okay, well, if we want anyone other than old white men to be in these roles, then we need to accept that you need to put in things in place that enable people who have children and are going to have some of those responsibilities to also be able to do this role.
That's part of it. Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Let's have a numbers round. Emily, what's your number?
38.
What's that?
That's the number of states who have now ratified the Equal Rights Amendment.
Yay! We got another one. Who's the latest?
The latest was Virginia, which their legislature yesterday, House and Senate, both said yes to the ERA.
And this has been going on since the 60s?
So, if you really want to know. So the ERA was first conceived in the 20s.
Wow.
And they kept proposing it in Congress, which all the men in Congress said, no, 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 no. Finally, 1972, they said, fine, and voted the ERA out of Congress. And it went to the states for ratification. And everyone was really excited. A lot of states ratified it. But then conservatives got really upset and they started talking about bathrooms and stuff.
It's always bathrooms.
It's always the bathrooms. And bathrooms, gay marriage, and housewives, I don't know, blah, 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 backlash, blah, blah, blah. So the whole thing kind of ends in 1982 with only 35 states.
And how many do you need?
38, Felix.
Oh, this is it?
Yeah.
So now it's going to, we have a new constitutional amendment?
No. So now it's kind of a mess because they revived the effort, the three-state strategy in like 2015 or 2016. They got the three states was Arizona, Illinois, and now Virginia. However, there was a deadline for ratification. The deadline was 1982.
Oops.
Activists are like, the deadline was unconstitutional because the last time we amended the Constitution, it took literally from James Madison to George H.W. Bush. That's how long it took from proposing okay. So they're like, it's fine. It's unconstitutional. We'll get the deadline removed. And then, you know, and then in the meantime, some of the states that ratified, like, are trying to take it back.
Unratifying.
They're trying to rescind, which like, probably
like
is
Steph
illegal.
Curry, that she's like, unresigning.
Yes, it's just like Steph Curry. And also now, if we were in the Obama years, this is probably go and get into the Constitution, but we're not. So some the Republican attorney generals in three states are like, no ERA, it's bad. They filed a lawsuit to stop it.
So what, just let's rewind
just forever.
Very quickly, because this is the lightning numbers round, but in like a real nutshell, what does the ERA actually do and why do Republican attorneys general oppose it?
So in a nutshell, it's unclear what the ERA would do. It's a line. It says that you would not be denied equal protection under the law because of sex. That's it. That's all it says. So you'd think, so whatever, just stick it in the Constitution, like make the ladies happy, right? So, yeah, it's the kind of thing like once it went into the Constitution, then there would be lots of like laws that would be passed and lawsuits that would be filed. And you'd kind of like figure out what it means over the years and decades, just like all the other ones, right? The reason they're the Republicans are upset, I don't know. They think it'll lead to more abortion rights and things like that. And they don't want equality for women. They don't want equal pay, lawsuits and all this stuff. And the bathrooms. I honestly don't understand why you would oppose something like that. There was even a piece in the New York Times, an editorial from a feminist, Joan Williams, who's like a work-life advocate kind of person, saying like, we shouldn't even do this because if it did get into the Constitution, conservatives would go bonkers and file all kinds of crazy bathroomy kinds of lawsuits that would just turn everyone against women, basically. So, I mean, it's crazy. Anyway, go on.
Okay.
Someone else do a number.
All right. I'm going to do $36.2 billion, which is the number of dollars that J.P. Morgan made in profit in 2019, which is not only a record profit for J.P. Morgan, it is a record profit for any bank ever in the history of America and is more than double the highest amount of money it ever made at the height of the pre-crisis in like 2007. It is beyond like enormous profits. And part of it is the Trump tax cuts. They're like paying lower taxes, but most of it isn't. Most of it is just like these banks in general and JP Morgan in particular are just raking in money hand over fist and no one is competing that away and they just get to make more and more money. And I guess the employees who in the pre-crisis go-go years of Wall Street would just eat up all of those extra profits in terms of bonuses, don't have that amount of leverage anymore. And so their bonuses, like you don't hear quite as much about the, you know, eight-figure bonuses anymore. And so now it just goes to shareholders. Yay!
Bankers don't get big bonuses?
They get paid bonuses.
They get paid bonuses.
The base salaries are higher and the bonuses are lower. That's part of the post-crisis, you know, financial regulation.
Yeah, and this is something we can also, it's a larger discussion.
Yeah.
Talk about in a non, my number is really like not that interesting.
What's your number?
My number, I think it's kind of interesting, is 97.5.
Is that a percentage as well?
It's not a percentage. It's a temperature. Turns out humans are getting colder.
What?
What?
I knew
yes.
It.
No longer is 98.6 actually the average temperature. It is 97.5.
Oh, this is a so Fahrenheit.
Yes. Ah. Yes.
Do you understand Fahrenheit?
I do. I've been living in America for 23 years now. And so here, just for those listeners who don't speak American, hey Siri, what's 97.5 degrees Fahrenheit in Celsius?
97.5 degrees Fahrenheit is 36.4 degrees Celsius.
There you go. 36.4 in real money is now the official, and that's the average temperature of like human beings in the world.
Yeah. So basically, they've had the same thing for like 150 years. And it's not that they think that it was wrong. They think that people are actually getting slightly colder.
And is this global or is this American?
I think it's considered global. Like I'm hesitating slightly because I know the article. I believe the people they were looking at were essentially all American. But I believe the person who first came up with it was, I think, German.
Oh.
So
does that mean to have a fever, like fevers are lower? Like your temperature,
you would think they would be, right?
I don't know.
Right. I mean, I would imagine.
It's always very controversial at the Peck household, who has a fever and who doesn't. We're always trying to figure it out.
Yeah, I think part of the reason I've been sick much over the last 2 weeks, I've been constantly taking my temperature. So that's also, I think, why I was like, it turns out.
So there you have it. If your temperature is above 36.4 or 97.5, depending on like what language you speak, then you're running a temperature. So I say to all of you parents out there, just hand out those sick notes with abandon, because even when you thought it wasn't the temperature, it probably was. But that's because I always side with the kids, and I think they should just stay home from school. On which note, I think we'll wrap this up. Thank you very much for listening to Slate Money. Thank you, Jessamine and Molly, for producing. Thank you, Anna and Emily, for being amazing. And thank you all lovely listeners for keeping the emails coming on slatemoney@slate.com. We will talk to you next week on Slate Money.